Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Appreciate having you NSP folks here to talk to us about your integrated resource plan and go through that. I think we have allocated, I was just going to check the calendar, how long do we have allocated for this?
I just looked, Commissioner. We noticed them both at the same time from 1 till 3.
Okay. Just to ask the company, how long did you expect your presentation to take? And in your minds, how long did you allocate?
I think we probably have an hour to an hour and a half.
Okay.
And then just however much time you'd like to spend with us on questions.
All righty. And then we have Otter Tail in the room as well. Did we commit to a certain amount of time for you guys? Where's Jerry?
It should be a fairly short.
Okay. Just want to make sure we allocate the time appropriately. I think we've blocked off till 3.
I'm fine.
Are you guys free until 3 later than that?
Yeah.
A little bit. Okay. I have a 3:15, so dangerous to leave blocks of time open on your calendar because they'll get filled. All right. Well, we better get at it then. I think we'll just right away just go around and introduce ourselves, and then we'll pass it over to the company to make their presentation and proceed that way. I'm Julie Fedorchak. I'm a commissioner and chair of the commission. And I'll start over here with Randy.
Randy Christman, commissioner.
Brian Koch, commissioner.
I'm Chris Clark. I'm president of NSP.
Laura McCartan, regional VP with NSP.
Paul Johnson, new director of resource planning and bidding at NSP.
Kurt Hager, managing director of resource planning, NSP.
Victor Shook, public utility analyst with the commission.
Mike Diller, PSC analyst.
All right, and that's everyone at the table, and I think in the essence of time, we'll skip going around the entire room. But there's an audience of very handsome people gathered to listen to this discussion. We'll leave it at that. Okay. All right, without further delay, then we'll turn it over to you, Chris.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll just quickly kick it off here by I just wanted to say we really appreciate the invitation to come and visit about our resource plan with the North Dakota Commission. We think this is a really important part of the discussion. We look forward to sharing some of what we did in building this resource plan and starting a conversation. This is obviously a big resource plan, and there are a lot of complex issues in it. Those are important issues for all of our states to engage in, so we look forward to that. And I think maybe that's my way of saying we hope this is a first but not the only engaged discussion we have on our resource plan. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Kurt Hager to provide some overview of what we'd like to accomplish, and then he and Paul will walk through the PowerPoint that we have.
Chris, if you could just give you my perception. The IRPs, I think this is great discussion. But I wouldn't read, for me personally, too much into this as a blessing or non-blessing, because the commission in my time, we've kind of been silent on IRPs to let each individual case filter through. So the fact that we may not say we'd like or dislike something doesn't mean that we like it or dislike. I mean, it's just, I don't want, for me personally, to send the wrong signal. If I don't ask any questions, it means I'm okay with everything you're saying.
Very good.
I don't think I could be any clearer than that, but I wanted to put that out front early.
Sure. I think that's very helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Well, just that's not a unique thought. I made this point once before that I'm concerned about that, and that being relatively new here, but the fact that the commission has not approved resource plans in the past, that not be taken as an approval just because we don't disapprove of something and then used that way in a potential rate setting case we said we were going to do this 12 or 14 years ago and you didn't say no, so it must have meant yes. So that's certainly not the case.
Commissioners, this is Laura McCartan. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate that perspective. What we found, I think, in the years since we've been bringing our resource plans here and having these conversations, it's been very helpful for us to engage in those conversations with you. So regardless of anything else, we appreciate the opportunity and look forward to your questions as we go forward.
Just a couple opening remarks. I will introduce here Paul at the end. Paul is Steve Wishart's replacement, so you know, used to know Steve. He is the director of NSP resource planning out of Minneapolis, and Paul has taken that position, and I'll get to that in just a minute. To start with, you know, we look at the resource plan, as we started this discussion, as a first step in a very long road that ultimately has to address the issues with our baseload and aging fleet. Our fleet is aging. It's going to, majority of our baseload plants reach a year, 60-year life in the 2025 to 2035 timeframe. And so we need to start addressing that. And part of this discussion is setting that the system up so we can address those issues. And so that's one of the things that when we look towards the future, exactly what does our system going to look like going forward? The preferred plan and the overall resource plan attempts to balance a number of issues. And obviously there's difference of opinion on those issues. But certainly reliability, we want to make sure that we maintain a reliable system. One, two, cost impacts to customers. It has to be reasonable, it has to be affordable so customers can actually get the power they want. Three, how do we identify current and future risks and how do we deal with those risks? We'll talk a little bit about gas price risk, why we designed a plan to minimize that going into these other large decisions. Because we expect that gas will be a part of those large decisions, and we didn't want to become over-supplied or over-reliant on natural gas at a time that it's still fairly volatile. And again, the last one is really setting us up for the future. How do we move through this plan on a long runway to make those decisions? I mean, if you look at how this plan is structured, many of the actions don't happen till 2020, 2025 to 2030. We know that there's a number of issues that we have to work through, both at the federal level, technology changes, and what's going to happen in our various states. And we tried to set a plan up and a process so that we have a long runway to start to look at those issues, see how they start to play out before we have to make too large of commitments. And so that's what the plan's attempted to do.
Sure. When do you factor in your time frame coming in front of the commission for ADP to when you need the generation? I don't think ADPs expire, so I'm just curious when you do that.
Typically, we would do that once we've actually got to the point of selecting a specific type of resource. And so is it something that we're going to propose to build, or would we issue an RFP and we get those results for the RFP, and then would we bring those results back to the commission for ADP at that time so that when we have the discussion about what you're approving, we'll actually know when it's going to be in service, what the cost is, what the size is, and what the function that that asset would have in our portfolio. So, again, you look at kind of the timing usually between in-service dates and when that process happens, and it's usually in that five-year range. Some resources are a little bit, like a CT could be maybe anywhere from 2.5 to 5 years, but it's usually in that range.
I mean, personally, the sooner you come in for ADPs, the better. Once you get the data you need, they don't expire, I don't think. So,
yeah, it's really getting to the point so we know exactly what we're proposing so that you guys can actually look at it and make it meaningful. So, and I think the most important thing is the filing is the beginning of the process. You know, it really is. We put on the table our vision. We put on the table a number of scenarios to look at around that vision. And what we're here today is to review that with you. It's to go through and identify exactly how did we get some of the rationale, some of the assumptions that went into that process. And then ultimately, we want to enter into that dialogue with you. What are the issues that you have? What are the concerns you have? And what are the questions you have? Because, again, this is a pretty long road. I mean, when you think about it, most resource plans take somewhere between 12 months, sometimes 2 years to actually complete. And then we're going to have numerous resource plans filings that will start to look and modify and make it more specific as we go out in time. So the closer we get to that 2020 and 2025 timeframe, we'll be back here a number of times actually talking about how things modify or change as things start playing out. So, again, I think this is important. This is kind of a first step, and it's not the final step. With that, I'd like to introduce Paul Johnson. Paul, again, has 37 years of experience within kind of electric resource planning and in that area. He spent a large portion of his career at Minnesota Power, Since then, he moved to Virginia and worked for a co-op out there, a G&T co-op, for a few years. Then he came back to Minnesota and is working now for us doing resource planning. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Paul to go ahead and go through the specifics of the plan. Any questions before we start?
Okay, well, good afternoon. I'm Paul Johnson. A couple of things in front of you. We have a copy of the presentation for those that want to have that. There's more on the table here. You can take notes or just for that. And then complementary to the presentation, there's the packet on assumptions, scenarios, and sensitivities. And rather than put a lot of
you'll have to have that microphone pretty close in order.
Rather than put a lot of information onto the slides, we chose to use the handout. It's about 10 pages to give you kind of a feel for the breadth and the scope of some of the things we looked at and how that kind of funneled down to the preferred plan that we'll be spending some time on today.
I should have asked this question before. Will Minnesota actually bless this plan ahead of time? Well, other states, when will they make that decision? Like, I think their policy is different than ours. I mean, will they actually say, we agree with this plan, and then do that ahead of time?
You know, typically what Minnesota is, we'll go through a process in Minnesota that they will review the plan. What they usually approve is some form of action steps that come out of the plan. And so those action steps might be a specific need and a process to fill that need, such as an RFP process, or it could be a certificate of need that is filed in conjunction to it. So they typically approve the action steps with the plan. They don't necessarily approve in the entire plan.
And it's just kind of off the cuff here, but you know, that's maybe where the points of divergence in state policy will come. And so as they get to where they're making decisions, maybe there's a dialogue that we could have that's somewhere between an ADP and this, so we could, I don't know, level out some of those friction points. It's just a thought.
Well, and in fact, as I said earlier, I really believe that this is a first step, because I'm hoping that we're up here more than just today having a dialogue about how do we balance these between the various stakeholders. Because I think that's so important. That's what we're trying to do is, when you look at that future, how do we build a system that's robust enough and that's balanced and that gives as many of the customers, including North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin, the type of resources and system that they want? So I think we're going to have more discussion than we had in the past to see to how do we come up to a conclusion that makes sense for everybody.
I do have one question sort of on the front end, and this might be something you have planned to address in your presentation, but this E21 group that helped advise the development of this plan, if you could provide some background on who they are, what that initiative was, and how it emerged, and what you know, official role or unofficial role that group played in the development of this plan, and why, I guess.
I can do that. The E21 group is a group in Minnesota that we pulled together. Actually, others came to us and were engaging in a conversation and asked us to be part of it. So it was a diverse group of stakeholders, from low-income advocates to environmental parties, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which is a regular intervener in our rate cases, and then our large industrial customers who intervene in our cases as a group called XLI. Their attorney was part of the group. We also had the city of Minneapolis and some other groups who have interest in shaping energy policy. They're groups that typically play in the resource plan or in rate case dockets. They wanted to actually talk about what's the future model for the utility. And so we agreed to engage in a year-long process with them where we spent one day a month actually talking about what that would look like. There are other states around the country who are engaged in these processes. Probably the one that gets the most attention is the REV process in New York, where they're looking at different solutions to try to address issues that utilities have, and things like, should you create a distribution system operator similar to like the MISO for the transmission system. So what we did was just meet with this group and talk about what the future of the utility looked like. the different goals that people want addressed. And those included things from the customer groups wanting to focus on making sure the rate case pressure didn't get too extreme from all the things that people want us to do, and then all the things that people want us to do. So how could we look at having more of a two-way communication on our distribution system as we move into a future where maybe there's more distributed generation? How can customers have more choices? So we hear some large customers want to meet corporate goals on sustainability, and they are looking to us to see, can we provide solutions? We also have cities like Minneapolis who was very vocal in wanting certain types of sustainability goal. And so people wanted to talk about those things, and people also wanted to talk about how do we modernize the grid going forward. So it was a place for that dialogue. What we did coming out of that was we brought to the table wanting to change the rate case process, particularly in Minnesota. Like in North Dakota, we had great success, from my perspective, in achieving a multi-year solution out of a rate case. And we really think those frameworks are helpful. We hear a lot of times from our larger customers, our business customers, that having a predictability in what the rate increases are going to be over the next couple of years is helpful to their budgeting. So we were trying to bring those ideas to the table of, look, we're all sort of bringing what we want out of the future to this. And so coming out of that, we actually made good progress with that group. There was some consensus in meeting of minds on what some good recommendations were. And so part of what we did was took those recommendations and filed with the commission and said, we think that there was some success from this E21 group. We don't want it to just be a white paper, but we actually want to engage in discussion with these groups going forward. We know that the resource plan is a likely place for that discussion to carry over. We also want to have a discussion about, can we get to a multi-year rate framework in Minnesota? That's something that we really want to accomplish. So we were trying to signal that out of this group that voluntarily got together and met and talked about these things, can we actually drive it into the Minnesota process as we consider the resource plan and whether or not we have to file a 2016 rate case in Minnesota. And some of those lessons from that E21, I think, will be of interest to other states, and we'll have opportunities to share those. Others were more, how can we try to change the Minnesota process to what we've been able to do successfully in some of our other jurisdictions, like our Colorado utility did with a multi-year case in Colorado, and we did here in North Dakota with a multi-year case. So that's really a quick overview of it.
So they just fed, some of the recommendations fed this process. They weren't really involved any other way directly in developing this plan.
That's correct. They were, it was more creating, there's a series of recommendations that are attached to a filing that we put in December that we can share with you that'll kind of share some of the things that those people were thinking about. And they're not things that'll surprise you. It's things that, you know, everybody sort of brought their own interests together, but we tried to put them together in a way that if you look at how do we want to build this for the future, these things could actually fit together. And so that was really the exercise. I think it was helpful to us as we put together the resource plan, but it's not like that group then helped us put the resource plan together.
Did that include, like, people who were elected by the people in some of your various states, or are these people who have appointed themselves as representatives of certain groups?
For the most part, it was stakeholder groups like those in, like the Chamber of Commerce and the industrials. We did have people from the city of Minneapolis, and we did have a representative of the Department of Commerce in Minnesota attend the meetings that one of the commission staff from Minnesota attended. But we really, part of why we filed the letter with the commission was to actually move it from a group of people who just wanted to get together and share ideas into the public process where everybody has the ability to poke at it and ask questions.
Thank you.
So we have a couple dozen slides, and we have kind of a little process to kind of set it up and then take you through a little bit of a journey here. And the first part is, you know, we'll talk about the process of the plan requirements and so forth, the key assumptions, the scenarios that we developed to kind of get a feel for what the key decisions and configurations of future plans might be or could be based on what seems plausible, and then testing those against sensitivities to see if there's a fluctuation in gas, coal, load, carbon costs, if they materialize and so forth, what's the robustness or the resiliency of any one of these plans? And then we end up out of that with a recommendation of a preferred plan that seems to be most resilient given the uncertainties of the future. So that's where we're going. So this slide is just a quick overview of the process that we used to develop the plan. We pulled together a snapshot of what our current projection for energy and capacity needs are, the associated costs of that existing configuration. We then look at both supply and demand side resource options that could be used to meet projected future needs and get information about those. And then we make sure we review the statutory requirements, which would include where the commission left off last time and what their guidance was to us going forward, and also interim dockets and activities that happened between where we ended off last time and where we started with the plan development to make sure we're cognizant of that as we develop the plan. The plan itself takes a 15-year view, so it goes out through to, it's the year you file it and then you go 15, so it'd be out through 2030. We look at maintaining reliability of our existing power supply, and any changes we make to that are highly sensitized to keeping that reliable, and our backbone resources such as nuclear and coal are a big part of that. The future energy mix. The energy mix is responsive to requirements, future environmental outcomes, potential, and also preserving, and as you'll hear about later, the expandability of pieces and parts of your generation fleet to address future retirements and changes in the power supply portfolio. Costs, very high cost sensitivity in terms of whatever plan you come up with has to have, you know, cost controls within acceptability. Environmental performance, maintaining and improving the environmental performance not only of the existing generation, but any generation resource that you add has to meet not only our objectives as a company, but also the requirements that are put upon them by regulators and permits, et cetera. And the compliance requirements, going back to the statutory requirements, the plan that you come up with has to meet the state rules, has to meet the state objectives of our entire upper Midwest area, and also those order point requirements that interveners pay very close attention to see if you've actually addressed those explicitly in the plan that you file.
So on that note, when you say has to meet state stuff, so the renewable mandates of Minnesota have to be met.
That is
correct.
That's
a bet. That's a planning assumption no matter what the cost is?
Yes, Commissioner Polk, yes. Not no matter what the cost. There is a provision in the resource planning rules that has a rate impact test and also a reliability impact test. Not they don't call it a test, but if there's a risk to reliable service that's significant or that there's a cost impact that's beyond what's in the public interest.
Who determines if it's significant?
That would be the commission.
Of Minnesota.
Yeah, based on the record that's established for them to deliberate over. That's
correct. Friction point two.
Excuse me?
Friction point two. Yeah. Well, make a note.
Sure. And I think one of the issues that, as you'll see, as you go through the plan, when we add the sensitivities of the different runs, we understand those friction points. And we try to do sensitivities and we provide the analysis so you can see the opposite side. So you'll see in the plan where we've deemed it the North Dakota option, just to make it clear that certainly we see different views and different scenarios set up. And so not only did we do primary scenarios, but we also did a number of sensitivities associated with what you would expect to see that your requirements are. And we wanted to lay that out so we had kind of the both stories on the table, so that when we have the discussions both here and in Minnesota, that we have a full set of data that people can look at and see what happens to those differences. So we try to recognize, Commissioner Kalk, that we do understand.
As long as there's a trigger point, if you will, it's not no matter what. You've got some caveats built in there that we could all discuss at that time.
Yeah, and one of the things that you'll see as we go through here is somewhat of the rate impacts. You know, one of the guiding principles, again, was cost impact to customers. And we said we were trying to keep it within a 2% on average rate impact over the long term. That's one of the concepts that we bring forward. So as Paul goes through this, kind of keep that in mind, that we understand that those are the friction points and the things that we need to come and work out and talk about.
Okay, so then you file a plan that meets those objectives there, and you begin what can be a very long process of stakeholder interaction, both formal and informal, the formal piece being what we call information request process, to paper interactions and information exchange, mm-hmm. leading up to a full record that the commission then can use to decide what it wants to do with that particular resource plan, accept, modify, reject, and so forth. And then the resource acquisition piece of this would be taking an approved plan. If there is resource acquisition that's required to implement that, the timing and nature of that acquisition would then be implemented either near term or further out, depending upon what's required. Let's see if it.
I think point it up at that thing.
Point at that thing. Oh, yeah. There we go. Okay, so as with any plan, you have to take a snapshot on current circumstances, and you have a backdrop that you or a context that you plan from. And this kind of illustrates some of that backdrop. We have a baseload, very strong baseload portfolio of nuclear, Monticello, Prairie Island 1 and 2, and Sherco 1 and 2. Their license expirations and end of 60-year life is in the 2035 time frame. It's just outside of our planning horizon, but we know we're going to have to need to address that starting as soon as 5 to 10 years prior to those expiration or end of 60-year life periods. So that's something that we're cognizant about. Secondly,
do you assume that you couldn't get more life out of them?
There is potential for life extension, but we have not addressed the nuclear issue in this particular resource plan, but we have told interveners that is something that we will be addressing more specifically in our next resource plan a couple of years from now.
Okay.
So EPA has their Clean Power Plan 111D that's out there. Final rules are promised in June of this year. There's divided opinion as to what they will be or what they won't be and what they will actually result in. And we've tried to develop, again, with the uncertainty of that, a variety of ways to evaluate it and have responsiveness in our plan to whatever that outcome might be. Thirdly, natural gas supply and price. I mean, I was out in Virginia, and I'm very familiar with the Marcellus complex and what people are doing out there, and the movies about fracking right in the backyard of Pennsylvania where that goes, where it doesn't go, but there's tons of gas out there. And as you can see from our forecast, the projections of real significant increases in gas price are not there, but who knows what the future will bring. So, again, we plan for a wide range of potential outcomes in our planning.
How do you factor in the need for building transmission based on what generation you might or might not use, as well as the need for pipeline capacity? That those numbers got to be figured in there. If they're not, that's a flaw.
And we do.
So that's all you,
Commissioner Kalk? Yes, we do.
You've got a suite of transmission projects that might be required because of this, and a suite of gas projects too.
Yes, we in the various components,
okay,
of any, you know,
it's in there.
Yep, it is in there. We do have to address specifically both transmission
gas. So when do you start working those through MISO to build, or those all be on XL ratepayers? Those transmission costs?
Well, it depends upon the nature of the transmission. If it's specific to a project, then it would be assigned to the project. If it's a MISO MTEP project where it goes to the entire grid benefit, then it's an allocation. So, technology development's part of planning. You're looking out 15 years, you got to be looking at what's on the horizon in terms of technologies. A couple of them that are getting more and more attention are Solar, of course, it's in its infancy. We don't know how fast or how much is really going to come on and what the economics long-term are really going to be. So we have to make some assumptions about that. And that's beginning to ramp up on our system in terms of both customer and utility scale interest, as well as the state requirement in Minnesota. Batteries, I mean, that's been a long and drawn-out process. For EPRI's been doing this since Chauncey Starr started EPRI in 1974. That was one of his first things that he talked about, was batteries and storage as a part of his first family of R&D. And we're still trying to crack the egg on, you know, energy intensity, big batteries, and as for utility-scale applications. So we're monitoring that closely as well. So criteria for plan selection, we've touched on a few of these things. We as a company have paid particular attention to several. Kurt's already mentioned managed customer impacts. We're highly sensitized to that, and we're really put the test on the preferred plan of averaging no more than a 2% annual increase incremental above our current situation, and the preferred plan does address that.
Did you mean 2% above the reference case?
Yes, 2% above the reference case. Right. Yeah, Mike. Yeah, so flexibility to adjust the plan. I mean, any good plan has to have substantial flexibility at relative swings in cost. And as you'll see from our preferred plan, we've tried to push the big decisions out as far as we can and limit the amount of front-end additions to give us that flexibility. The plan does not illustrate commitments. It illustrates future choices and outcomes and a blend of different resources to meet certain objectives that we think are reasonable to put on the table, knowing what we know today, but recognizing that we have the flexibility to modify and change that based on actual circumstances that materialize into the future. Maximizing existing assets. We spend a lot of money on our existing generation and transmission. We want our customers to get the full benefit of that, and our plan reflects that. We're not looking to diminish the capabilities of any of our generation or transmission facilities until it's absolutely necessary or required for a specific reason. So, ensure system and customer reliability. We want a robust power supply and transmission system. We want to maintain our good record with our customers of having very little disruption, regardless of what makes up that power supply. So that's a key criteria. Set the course for the future. You have to take the advantage of the opportunity with a long-term plan to show some leadership to the commission, to your interveners, saying, we heard you, we recognize there's a lot of things that are out there on the horizon, and we want to set the course towards offering ourselves both progress on the objectives that make sense for us to pursue and yet maintaining the flexibility on actual commitments for as long as we can.
Doesn't that conflict with what you just said about when you were on the flexibility to adjust the plan button? You were kind of saying we're putting off all the big decisions until there's more clarity. Isn't that just the opposite of the leadership you just talked about now?
Commissioner Christman, I would say that setting the course, meaning you can say, here's the direction we're taking. We're taking initial steps that we need to take now, but still preserving the big decisions that support that direction as an ultimate commitment till as far out as you can until you actually need to spend the money or commit to those resources. That's the distinction I would make. Okay. Achieve environmental requirements and goals. We have changing environmental requirements and goals. We're all familiar with that in this room. Our emphasis is to maintain our current requirements that are on the books, both regulatory, law, permit, et cetera, and yet not put a deaf ear to changes that are in the wind and have a plan that's flexible to swing one way or the other, depending upon what actually comes out of that environmental policy initiatives. The backdrop here is requirements. Our bottom line is we want to meet all the requirements that are put upon us and do them well while maintaining or having a plan that has flexibility to meet what comes at us in the future. Building the preferred plan, we have three main components of that. We have to look at our assumptions, which are the building blocks relating to gas, coal, load, et cetera. And we rely on a lot of information from independent experts like Wood Mackenzie, PIRA, CIRA, et cetera. It's not our own opinion. We rely heavily on people that know this and monitor it and have big staffs that put this information together. Scenarios are, in short, it's a grouping of resource options and decisions to meet future needs. You have here, we can do it with coal, gas, more nuclear, wind, solar, DSM, long-term purchases from Manitoba Hydro, a variety of things, and we put that together in a framework that has all these criteria around it and the decision points that relate to when you actually would need to do any one of those resource decisions to support an overall plan outcome. And then sensitivities. You got to test these scenarios. You got to test them hard against fluctuations in the future, because none of us in this room know where these things are really going to go. We have a snapshot today. We have a belief of where it might be going. But you have to have a robust plan that's resilient given fluctuation and some key sensitivities. So out of that effort, which is a very concerted effort, comes out a preferred plan.
So how do you build in what you've already committed to build in North Dakota? You've got a commitment in your last rate case to build 400 megawatts of thermal. So that needs to be, my opinion, needs to be built in now. And how is that already built in, that you're going to build those megawatts in North Dakota?
Well, the resource plan doesn't specify siting.
You've made a commitment to build stuff here.
I understand that, Commissioner Culk, but I'm just telling you the nature of a resource plan. The implementation part of that gets to where and specifically when you're going to build. The plan itself has never been designed, the planning process is not designed to specify a location of a resource. It just says
I don't want to derail the discussion. I'll just throw this comment out for me personally.
Okay.
The sooner you get that built in North Dakota, the more acceptable I will be to other renewable things that pop up in other states.
Okay.
How does that sound for being as clear as day?
No, I understand.
Right? If you build it here, then I might be more likely to support renewables in other states. If
right.
you try to build all that other stuff and never just keep pushing ours out.
And we are aware as a company of potential new load and opportunities in the state of North Dakota, and we are looking into that.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. So I can't, if you look at the handout again, and I'm not going to take us through that, but just for purposes of quick reference, pages 2 through 10 are a good summary of some of these key assumptions. And then and that's what we're going to pick a few of those that we consider to be some key drivers just for purposes of today to begin this dialogue about the plan. Projected capacity needs, demand-side management, carbon dioxide price, which we call it a proxy price at this point, energy and demand forecast, natural gas price forecast, renewable pricing. Got to point it towards the, come on. Oh, there you go. Okay. So this is, I don't know, does this have a pointer?
It should, I think, if you press the very center of it.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Thank you. So nuclear going strong through the entire planning period. No adjustments there. We have the Monticello uprate that's reflected. The coal remains strong through the entire planning period. No reduction in capacity. Now, this is capacity, iron in the ground. It does not reflect the energy output. So we have reflected here at expiration of our Manitoba Hydro contracts in the 2024-2025 timeframe. For purposes of planning, we're not assuming an extension of those at this time.
What about that new hydro coming online up there? How does that plan out?
Do you want to address that?
Sure. The kiosk dam, which is the next one that comes up, actually helps support us stepping up from our 375 megawatt purchase up to 500 with Manitoba. So in 2021, that'll be a part of it. Kiosk is also situated to serve other customers. The dam that they would need to build to continue our purchase from them is the Kanawapa Dam. And the Kanawapa Dam is almost a 1,500-megawatt dam that they would need to build by 2030. They were told by their utility board that they would have to build that as a merchant dam and not as a regulated utility dam. And so Manitoba and us are still in discussions about what would that mean to both of us. And so one of the reasons we reflect the expiration of the contract on its date is because we don't have an exact clear path yet on what a potential continuation of the contract would look like. And if it is dependent upon Kahnawake, then the question is, can Kahnawake be constructed in a way that makes sense for both parties? And so we'll be discussing that certainly with Manitoba in the next coming year or so, but it is more complicated than just a renewal. Correct. It's a brand new structure, a large structure. The kiosk structure, I think, is, if I remember correctly, 500-ish, but the Kahnawake is 1,495. So it's going to be a large structure, large dam that would have to be constructed to have them continue our sale.
What's the time frame on that?
It's a 10-year project, so it's a 2030 in service date, a 2020 start date. They're actually probably needing a path forward to start the regulatory process next year.
But in Canada, it's not a project; it's a project.
That's right. A.
You hear that? A.
Yeah. Got to keep it light.
That's
project
right.
A.
That's right. Project A.
Get some Labatt's and we're done.
You know how Canada was developed? C A N A D A.
I like that.
So just a couple of key points here on this one.
keeping it light.
Keeping it light. Moving on. See,
my 11-year-old will like that one too. Yeah.
That's why it fits so good with me.
Yeah. Easier to remember that way, probably. So the red resources up here are they're indicative of what we put in our preferred plan, and it's the gap, as you see here, from a capacity standpoint, really doesn't start hitting, as we said in our filing, until about the 23-24 time frame, given the plan we filed on January 2nd. And that's when we start having to bring on substantial capacity resources to fill that projected gap in capacity.
I don't want to derail this again in a different direction, but Laura, I know you have a lot of experience with nuclear and, you know, in the carbon restrained world that we're entering, it seems like nuclear should be part of the conversation and never is. And so you guys have some. You have some potential leadership positions you can use with your experience. What's happening with nuclear, and is it part of your future plans at any level?
Commissioner,
for growth, not just for maintaining what you have.
Well, Commissioner, I don't think we show it in this. We don't show any adding new nuclear in this out through 2030. Beyond that, I can't really say. So I think it kind of gets back to Paul's point in our future resource plans. That might be something we explore more of. Right now,
it's off the table now.
We don't see a need for it to meet our. I think it's not a need, a resource that best meets the need that we've identified in this resource plan, and I can let you guys speak to that more. So it's out more in the future. There are some plants being built in the United States now. They're very costly. So the cost of those things have to, I think, be more reasonable. But I agree with you, as a carbon-free resource, baseload resource, I hope that we as a country can turn our way back to that the federal government will step up and resolve the permanent disposal of used nuclear fuel, which there are really no technical barriers to doing that. It's a political thing. We keep working that front. So we will continue as a company to try to exert some influence in that political realm about the need to resolve that issue on a national level.
So there's natural gas is cheaper, basically, right now.
Yes,
that's why
right.
Everyone's going that route.
That's right.
Okay, so two pictures here, energy and demand projected out through 2030. You can see the upper and lower bounds there, the dashed line, the dotted line. That reflects an increase of the annual growth rate by 50% for the high side, a decrease in the annual growth rate 50% for the Lowell. The projected annual growth rate for both energy and demand is 0.4% per year. And that's just to give you a picture of kind of where things are going.
Is that across the whole system or is there a pocket?
This is across the whole system. That's correct.
Where's your biggest pocket to load? Is it Minneapolis?
Yes, the metro area. That's correct.
In normal times, your growth rate was what, 0.4%? That's pretty low.
Well, in 2000, I was just reading something. Just in 2010 through 2012, at one point, like from 1% to 0.7%, and then adjusted. But again, that's some of the changes that they have done in MISO and just how you're calculating different things as far as what your obligation is has kind of been shifting as well. So that does impact the demands, demand and capacity need side of things. So here we have natural gas pricing. It starts out with the short term on the NYMEX and short term strip, and then it graduates into the longer term view, which we get from Wood Mackenzie, PIRA, and CIRA. And again, the upper and lower bounds here are just an adjustment of 50% of that base case projected growth rate, just to give us sensitivity. Wind and solar resource pricing. This pricing actually came from RFPs, some actual bids that we received in 2013 for a very extensive wind RFP process, and then 2014 for our solar RFP. And the non-PTC price is put in here, and for a reason is because we're not adding any new PTC wind in our preferred plan. It's all non-PTC wind. None of it is relying on the production tax credit. The first that we add in the preferred plan beyond what's currently being built is 600 megawatts in 2020. And that's not for compliance. That's to meet an objective towards what we think might be necessary for carbon reductions. Again, that's not a commitment, but that's if we were to need a trajectory towards a carbon objective that actually materializes, the plan provides for that.
I will say one comment. You will see in the scenarios, and it's something that we will ultimately have to decide, is what benefits could be if we were to get PTC wind earlier at a lower cost. And so to the extent that there is a benefit, to the extent that we can capture that benefit, we would consider it. We do have scenarios that discuss that. So
the pricing here is reflective of that 2013 RFP pricing on wind, and then the fixed price we're saying at $95 per megawatt hour, which is an adjustment from the 30% ITC price in the 2017 time frame, and we're making the assumption that it would stay at $95 equivalent for a 10% ITC price through the entire period, given the infancy and youngness of the solar industry and the potential for substantial cost reductions and technology improvements in terms of panel conversion, similar to what we've seen in the wind industry over the last 10 years.
Is there something we can do to help with the hydro situation in Canada, or is that completely off the table for us to, I mean, can you invest XL dollars to fund that project up there that helps you get that low-cost hydro, or is that completely, it doesn't work that way? I'm just thinking of this, trying to go back to the hydro. If that hydro could continue out, that'd be huge.
Yeah, Commissioner Calk, we've actually thought about exploring some of those avenues with Manitoba. They are a Crown Corporation, and so therefore they're not allowed to have ownership outside of Canada of their assets.
Okay.
But we have started a discussion to explore alternatives along those lines, and that's exactly the type of thing that we would be seeing if it's feasible as we go through this year.
We could do ask us, because I know that Manitoba's in MISO, and that's a lot of, I'd call it baseload power, actually.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that, though, but in relation to the Manitoba Hydro, with all the problems that we've had in the last decade or decade and a half, with the fact that we became energy reliant on foreign nations for gas and oil, how far do we want to go with becoming reliant on a foreign country for our power?
Well,
And again, since we don't have any deal, we've got a long way to go on all of those questions, right?
That's a good point, though.
So this is just to depict the 60-year lives of our existing base load and to make the point that there's a lot of big impacts that are facing us in the post-2030 time frame, replacing about 70% of our capacity potentially in the next 20-25 years. And we're not, for the plan we have before you, we are not assuming or planning within that horizon to do any of that at this time. But doesn't mean we won't start looking at that in future resource plans, because we will, because of the long lead times for some of those decisions.
So what's the, explain the book Strategist and 60-year life.
The book is the actual book life of the resource, and the 60-year life is to show beyond the existing book life. To get to 60 years for Sherco 3, we'd have to go to 2046, 2047. Sherco 2, you'd have to go to 2037, and Sherco 1 about 2036 to get to the 60-year life. I mean, 60-year operating life. So.
And what's the strategist? Is that another model?
Strategist has the option of early retirement for Sherco 1 and 2 in it, given its current book life being ending in 2023-24. And our projection of the red band is that we would continue that operation as a planning assumption through 2030. So it's just illustrating that increment.
Was that set? Who set the book life up?
That's a filing that we make. I think it's every 3 years where you reestablish that.
Is it an accounting thing?
It's an accounting
thing. Right. We file the remaining lives of our plants. It's either addressed in the rate case or in separate filings. And if it's a separate filing, it usually then gets factored into the rate case when you're setting the rates. So our Minnesota end of life for Sherco 1 and 2 is the 2023 time frame. And so that's really what puts the great debate around that in the current resource plan, is a lot of folks would like to see those units shut at the end of their existing life. And part of what we're showing with that strategist is we can take them out to 2030. And then I guess probably the other part of that debate is with the EPA over what additional environmental equipment investments would be needed to actually continue to operate them out past 2023 with, and we talk about this in the resource plan, that at some point you may have to put something called SCRs on those units, and that's a big investment of dollars. And so that's really, you know, we've made the argument in the plan that that we think there's a valid argument to operate those units out to 2030 without SCRs. There'll be a lot of debate about that, but we were trying to really tee that up as how can we maximize the investment of that we've already made in 1 and 2 as part of this resource plan.
And is the book life just when it's at the end of the book life, it's been fully depreciated? Is that what it is? Okay, so it doesn't really have anything to do with whether or not there's the plant can technically function.
Right. When they look at the life, they're looking at, based on the investment we've made, how long do we think we can reasonably do it? The accountants do that exercise in conjunction with interviewing the people who operate the plants, and then they also take into account the where we are with the environmental equipment. So if you know that additional environmental equipment is required by a certain year, then you have to add that into the equation as well.
I think it's important to tell customers or the general public that when we're talking about retiring them at the end of its book life or whatever, I think people hear that as, oh, it doesn't work anymore. And that's not what we're talking about here. You might be able to get more time out of it. It's just, it's been paid for, and so it might be preferable by some to replace it with something else.
And I was going to say, that's kind of the 60-year life for a large power plant or a nuke plant. I mean, that they tend to say, okay, at that point in time, is it something to continue with the additional investments that might need to make it continue to run or not? Mm-hmm. And so that's the type of analysis. And certainly we're going to do that with the nuke facilities to see if that works. But this is trying to give you kind of a range of, you know, we're in that range of window of either deciding to put in large investments to try to keep it going or to make a decision to walk away from it. And I think that's kind of the ballpark we're in.
We file annually with the Minnesota Commission, and they review those lives, and then it gets factored into rate cases. And I think I would actually we'll have to check to see what we. I think in some of our states we've actually had some differences in what the remaining lives for plants are, so we could check and see what the where we're different from state to state on the remaining lives.
Yeah.
Right, they do. Yeah, they take it up, and it's a formal docket where they take comments on it by the Department of Commerce, and then it goes in front of the commission for an approval.
Outside
people are like, oh.
Right, it is outside of the rate case. Mm-hmm. And then it rolls in, the result rolls into the next rate case.
So just a quick turn to your handout. If you look at page 11 real quick, you know, only, I promise you I won't take you through all the fine print, but just to, it's more of an image to look at. That illustrates the family, page 11, that illustrates the families.
The
assumptions handout, Sherry, page 11. That gives you an idea of the breadth and scope of some of the types of scenarios that we developed. And you'll see on the screen now that we've kind of compartmentalized that into four different types, where you're looking at a reference case, something to build on as a comparison, and then you'll see down where it says preferred plan, there's four or five of those in there. That illustrates the preferred plan family, and then the center part of that page 11 really talks a lot about variations of what you could do if you were to retire one or two units at Sherco. So that's the Sherco family of scenarios. And then towards the bottom, right above the gray line on page 11, you'll see a North Dakota plan. And that's the final family. And so for purposes of a presentation today, we put them in those four groups. Now if you turn to the next page, page 12, then it gets real easy to read at that point. We've taken the liberty of just summarizing what you just looked at so you can actually make sense out of it.
Good.
And so looking at the reference case, what's in it is, just to quickly go through this, we have 187 megawatts of our RFP solar before the commission. We're going to have a hearing on it tomorrow. And that's our big reference case, and that's largely driven to meet the Minnesota requirement. We have a 400-megawatt component in there of wind, and that's largely to meet the carbon expectation of what we need to get to for reduction. We also we want to maintain, again, the investment benefit of Sherco 1 and 2, and that continues out through 2030, as Chris said, without any restrictions on its dispatch. It's only affected by the MISO dispatch. There's no environmental adders. There's no environmental constraints, anything. Just run the units, and however it's dispatched going forward and the impacts of that dispatch with the changing mix and economics is what comes out of that. And then adding small solar, because of our programs and interest being driven by our Minnesota customers, we have 100 megawatts of small solar by 2020. And so we chose the first one of the reference case to not assume any SCRs. That's our true base case. Then we move down to the preferred family. Our preferred plan, the baseline plan that we're talking about mostly today, is adding 200 megawatts of wind in 2020, an additional 1,200 of non-PTC wind by the end of the period, 1,700 megawatts of utility-scale solar, and an additional 400 megawatts of customer-driven small solar by 2030. That's the components of the preferred plan. Now, if the PTC option were to exist, we would think it would make sense to take advantage of that lower-cost option if it's available. and that would be up for accelerating up to 1,000 megawatts of that 1,800 as early as 2017. Then we look at, for purposes of people that are very interested in talking about Sherco retirement, we look at a Sherco 1 retirement within the preferred plan in 2025. And we also look at the Sherco 1 retirement with a PTC wind benefit. And then we move on the next family of four, retire 1 and retire 2 units, with 50 and 75%. That's meant to meet a Minnesota requirement for looking at, if you're going to do this, how could you meet the new capacity requirement due to retirement and expanding need with 50% renewable or 75% renewable. That's not our number. That's a number that's required by statute in the state of Minnesota to show what that would look like. So those four are not just, it's not an NSP scenario. It's a scenario to meet that requirement of the planning framework. The North Dakota plan, as Kurt mentioned earlier, it has no CO2 costs in it, no Minnesota or any other externalities. It has no new no renewable additions, no growth in small-scale solar. So it's basically taking the reference case and taking out all of those components that I've listed. The result of that is it adds, their model then adds three combustion turbines, one in 2019, one in 25, and one in 2030 to offset that change. So that's the scenarios that we put forward as a subset to test against the sensitivities, which is the next part of our presentation. And the full list of those sensitivities, again, if you look at the very back page of your assumptions handout, you'll see a very extensive list of variations of key drivers of cost and future circumstances that we tested. A subset of those is on the screen in front of you. And just some of these we've already covered in terms of load. We adjusted the load growth up and down by 50% in terms of the percentage growth. Natural gas, we covered that. CO2 costs value, the proxy there. We took the midpoint of what Minnesota has passed out, and that's $21.50 a ton to test it against that. But of course, we also tested it against no carbon costs, these scenarios, and a wide range of numbers in between that. So we would have a full body of information when we file the plan to be able to answer the questions. Mm-hmm. Not that we're advocating any one of those numbers, but we're saying here's the cost impact if those were applied against these scenarios to see if that did result, what is the cost, what does that look like, rather than having to do all of that after the fact. Mm-hmm. So we thought that was a prudent approach.
Paul, one quick question. Where did you factor in the 40% carbon emission reduction by 2030? Is that a baseline assumption with all of this, or?
I'll get to that when I get to the preferred plan.
Okay, so that's baked into the preferred plan?
It is an objective that we applied to the preferred plan to get to 40% by 2030.
Okay. But not all of the scenarios that you'll see achieve that.
Okay. Right. And where did that goal come from? Was that a company goal? Is that a Minnesota goal, the 40%? Or is that the EPA? You think that's what the EPA is going to require?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. The goal is a company goal. The state guideline is to get to 30% by 2030. We also recognize that the state and the feedback that we saw on other resource plans in the state of Minnesota from other utilities is that the goal of the state is to get to 80% reduction of carbon by 2050. And part of, if you were to look at that as a true goal, the trajectory that you'd have to set without going a lot of, you know, drastic changes, that 40% reduction by 2030 sets us on a reasonable guide path of some feasible decisions that can support getting close or on the right trajectory or glide path towards an 80% reduction by 2050 at a cost that we think is reasonable.
And is that a Minnesota goal, or is that just the people talking about that
80%? That is a Minnesota goal.
It is?
Yes, 80% by 2050. It's not a requirement, yeah. But it is a goal that
okay, objective.
Yes.
By the commission and interveners and so forth.
So that would be comparable in...
That would be comparable in authority to North Dakota's 10% renewable objective?
Voluntary. It's not required, yes. It would be voluntary. That's correct.
Just like Minnesota's 80%.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
The other thing I'll say is that the 40% carbon reduction objective kind of triangulates also with a potential 111D achievement. They're all kind of hit at the same point, and so it seemed like to us from a company perspective a good point to target to see that our plan ultimately might hit an 111D objective in our states.
Wasn't it 30%? The 111D?
Actually, it was total overall in Minnesota was a 41% reduction in carbon. You got to be careful with that because it's a completely different calculation because you have renewables and DSM and it's completely calculated differently. And it's also off a different measure because it's off of 2012 and not 5. But it just so happens that when we look at compliance, it triangulates pretty well.
Is yours on 05?
Ours is on 05.
Yep.
And one more thing, as long as we're on this discussion. The governor has thrown out a carbon free by some date, right, in Minnesota, hasn't? Coal free, yes. Is that something you are actively considering, or is that just, you're just, that hasn't really been vetted through the whole political process yet, so you're not?
You know, I've heard Governor Dayton say that he believes that at some point in the future there will be a coal-free future, but I haven't heard him put a date on it. I personally haven't.
Oh, I think I've seen stories where yes, but anyway, okay. It hasn't been blessed by the legislature yet in Minnesota, so okay, no. Thank you.
Not in statute or rules or anything.
Yeah.
Anywhere, so.
On the North Dakota plan, if I'm looking at...
Pat, why don't you come on up? You can join Victor over here and grab a mic. Thank you. Well,
on your assumptions handout for the North Dakota plan, then, is this an answer to Commissioner Kalk's question earlier? It looks like if you remove the CO2 and externality values from your IRP process, that 219 megawatts would be of natural gas fueled CTs would be added by 2030.
Three of them.
All of that size? 219?
That's correct.
Okay. It's not just one.
No, it's three of them. Yep.
But to follow on Pat's point, I thought of that too. It really means that you won't ever build that unless...
Yeah,
all those other scenarios take place.
Right.
Let us get to our preferred plan, and you'll see that there's a bunch of natural gas CT in there, too. Yeah.
Those are in addition to
okay.
1,750.
So well, let's get to it, but somewhere...
Those are additive.
Yeah, let's go right to the...
Let me just ask one question you can address wherever. The last page 14 of this handout here that says NSP current base assumptions... Just somewhere in there, you need to talk about where it says remove North Dakota load. I'm just curious what that means in there. So it says remove North Dakota to reflect the possibility of separating North Dakota from the integrated system at a future date. The demand and energy associated with North Dakota portion will remove starting in 2014. So I just, that jumped out at me.
Roll
that into your discussion somewhere.
Okay. Well, this is not... part of a scenario that we've tested or put into the Minnesota Commission is saying this is one of the scenarios that we've selected. That particular sensitivity or scenario was tested just to be illustrative of if that were to happen, what would that look like in anticipation of the ongoing dialogue between differences in Minnesota and North Dakota and the resource decisions related to serving the load in North Dakota versus Minnesota. It was not meant to say this is something that we consider.
Oh, no, if you want to sell the Otter Tail, they might be interested, yeah. But so I'm just curious what that meant.
As a part of our discussions when we were up here in December about the concept of as we have divergent state policies.
Exactly what would it look like if we were to look at having
North Dakota look at going on their own path. And so that was reflective of the discussions that we had in December that said, you know, if we're going to look at divergent paths, let's look and see what this ultimately looks like in this plan. And so that was, it was really reflective of the discussion that we had in December.
So we're running a little tight on time here, so I'm going to just keep moving quickly. Again, these are just some headliners that the plan itself allows for us to reach nation-leading carbon reductions. It doubles the amount of renewable energy. And part of the doubling of renewable energy is it's a no-fuel energy source, and we're thinking that it helps us to hedge against future gas price uncertainty. It also preserves the expansion capability of our gas fleet to be there when we really need it for baseload retirements post-2030 without overexpanding it prior to 2030. So it was a key part of the thinking of that. And if we can secure it at the cost that we think we can and have done so far, then once the gas pricing and the market pricing gets high enough, that's when we start adding a lot of those renewables. And in that context, the cost is cost-effective.
And a key, I'll just say, as we've talked over the years, we can't do a 15 to 25-year gas supply contract. We've done a 10-year contract. That's the longest one we've done in this for our company in probably the 20 years, in the last 20 years, since I've been here through almost 35, and used to do all the gas contracting. We've done one 10-year gas deal, and that's the longest we've ever been able to get, and that was very difficult. The idea of doing a 15 or 25-year natural gas fixed-price deal is almost impossible. And so when we look to wind and solar where we can get 20 and 25-year fixed-price deals, that does give our customers the consistency and the set price that they're looking for. And so that, when we look at the risk of the toll pie, you'll see this in the energy mix, we wanted to make sure that our risk to fluctuating prices is minimized, because we are going to go into a period that most likely we will have a lot of fluctuating price due to those baseload retirements.
I think we've already covered most of the items on this slide, so I'm just going to...
I don't know what we have.
Okay.
The last point, the natural gas CTs, I wanted to point out.
The natural gas CTs, the big part of the natural gas CTs is it gives you the lowest cost capacity addition with limited gas burn to meet the capacity requirements. The energy need is primarily being met by the renewables. So it doesn't, in this plan, where it does not trigger the more expensive capacity addition of combined cycle, nor the enhanced gas price risk of a combined cycle prior to when it's really needed and would be used to offset bulk baseload generation retirements post-2030.
Is this your preferred plan right here?
Yes.
Okay, so on the chart, there is no natural gas on here.
It says 1,750 megawatts. It should say right on there.
Solar.
Well,
wind.
It missed it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Right, you are right.
So should that say 1,700 megawatts of?
There is 1,700 megawatts of utility scale solar, but the part about these combustion turbines was not put on that more abbreviated description. It was an oversight. Sorry.
So, again, when we were talking about the three units additive for North Dakota, it's on top of the 1750 that's in the preferred plan. So the change between the preferred and the North Dakota adds three more CTs. So when you're looking at it, we have 10 total to meet Commissioner Culk's question of how would the North Dakotas fit in there?
And what you said about the inability to lock in long-term gas contracts, is that the reason why there's never any combined cycle plants in this mix? It's all CTs?
Actually, because we provide so much energy through the renewables, our CT fleet, our RCC fleet, continues to run at about the same range it's running today.
The big takeaway on this slide is we have the option between now and the mid-2020s to finalize our decisions on most of the resources additions that we've already described. So we have lots of flexibility. We're not, if it was the other way around, it would be a very committing kind of situation. But this is a planning horizon that puts most of those resource addition decisions out quite a ways, and we'll have two or three probably more resource plans about every 2 years before that gets much more defined and definitive based on actual outcomes and of policy and requirements in the market.
Exactly,
and so
to
forth.
Your point of approving the plan or not, or commenting or not, and locking in a decision or not, and we understand that this is a long runway.
I just did a it's a conflicting back viewpoint. If the value of CO2, if you have to, if there's a cost for CO2, then I think you should have a new coal plant in your mix with new technologies that capture the CO2 for something else. I mean, if you're going to be driving away from traditional coal because of CO2 costs, that also gives it a value that you can factor into some new technology like BNI and Alita working on. So maybe somewhere by 2030, you do build a new coal plant that has zero CO2 emissions, that captures the CO2 for oil recovery. Why didn't you put any of that in here?
Because the current
you're figuring in a value for what it's going to cost you to drive you away from it, then you should figure in the value to put it back in.
And we've actually looked at kind of what the current cost projections for some of those plants might be with carbon capture, and unfortunately they don't fall within the realm of what's cost effective now. This company, though, but it was 2005, 2006, we actually pursued an IGCC type of agreement.
But if that cost comes down the next decade, then can that float back into the model?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly. And so what I'm just saying is we actually did quite a bit of work on IGC to see if it was going to be a feasible technology for us. We've also done quite a bit of work on carbon capture from the standpoint of, because we're in Colorado and in Texas, we have plants that are close to the oil injection fields. We have Rangeley, Colorado, which is an enhanced CO2 flood. So we've actually done quite a bit of work to see if that would work even off a combined cycle unit.
Well, Chris and I talked about this earlier. I don't want to derail you again, but Elite and BNI are leveraging some stuff, and you work with them in other areas. So a new coal plant is not off the table, I don't think.
Yeah, if the technology, you're right. Mm-hmm.
Does this plan, putting so many decisions out to that 2025, 2030, should I hear what you're saying on flexibility, and you're kind of in a... You're kind of stuck right now with so much uncertainty, but doesn't that set up customers for experiencing a lot of rate increases at that time, that in that decade?
Yep, we got it coming up.
Okay.
Yep. So we think we've got a plan that's just a transition slide. We're well positioned for the future. You can see the contributions towards carbon reduction. If that becomes a material, if that materializes, the cost of achieving this kind of carbon reduction is within that 2% on average per year rate impact. It's not a huge cost over the horizon. Diverse energy supply. I think Kurt alluded to this. There's three or four key points here. Natural gas remains constant from 2015. To 2030 as a part of our energy mix, preserving its expansion capability to be, you know, up to a third or more if necessary after 2030 to offset requirements to retire one or more units, baseload units, nuclear or coal. Coal does reduce, but the reduction of coal energy is not due to some restriction that has been artificially put on it. It's truly a model dispatch impact. Reflecting the MISO dispatch because of the influx of renewables and gas and so forth. So it's not an artificial reduction. And
is it calculated in an externality cost?
There is no externality costs on that mix. We've done it both ways with PVRR, which has no externalities or carbon costs, and PVSC, which has the social cost of $21.50 in it. But the dispatch and the reduction does not reflect that influence, does not reflect that influence. Solar was non-existent in 2015, basically. Now it's 8% contribution of energy supply by 2030. The hydros remain pretty constant, except for the reduction in the energy contribution from Manitoba Hydro. Wind jumps up significantly from 15 to 25%. Nuclear, the fleet remains the same size. It's just that in terms of the bigger sea of energy requirement in 2030, it drops a couple percentage points. And overall, we're at 63% points of carbon-free electricity versus 55. And a big component of that, I might add, is nuclear.
Is there anywhere where NERC suggests that 25% wind is acceptable?
NERC, excuse me, Commissioner.
Is there anywhere where NERC has weighed in that 25% wind is acceptable?
There's been several studies, and we've done our own study too.
How about NERC?
NERC has, I'm not familiar with NERC putting up any issues regarding a 25% wind penetration, yeah. Nor has MISO.
Just to give you an example, the Colorado system, which is essentially on an island, will achieve essentially 24% wind penetration this year. So we're very close to it now, and with the next wind farm, we should be right at 25% wind. And it's on, like I said, more of an island than anything. It's not in a central dispatch, and because of the Rocky Mountains and Eastern Interconnect on one side, the Rockies on the other, it absorbs it all within that system.
Just a really quick footnote. I was on the first wind integration team study in Minnesota, the first two, 2004, 2006. Costs back then were $5 to $8 a megawatt hour integration estimates. Today it's $1 to $1.50. MISO is a lot bigger. They're smarter. There's more peaking capacity available to follow and handle intermittency of resources. And it's going to get even better as time goes out, as gas comes on more and more and more with peakers and combined cycles. That's the projection. It was the projection in PJM, and it's the projection in MISO.
I want to leave some time for Otter Tail, so this is one of those points you can write down to not confuse my silence with agreement.
So overall, we have very little rate impact incremental from preferred plan versus reference case on the front end. It does, as the chair did allude to, that gets up a little bit higher above 2% later on. But overall, on average, it's 2% or less.
And Chairman Fedorchik, this is the issue. You can see that the rate impact is somewhat loaded in those 5 years. But I think one of the things as we go through the process will be to determine, is it better to go ahead and spread those out a little, somewhat, or leave them backloaded? So I think that'll be exactly one of the questions that'll be asked as we go forward, as we start to see how wind and solar prices play out.
I don't expect to be on the commission then, so
why not?
Someone else can pass along those rate increases.
Well, Randy and I will be here. So.
Okay, all right.
You can just take that for what it's worth.
I'm going to be sitting as a consumer and going, what are you guys doing?
And build a third option in there between, you said spread them out or backload them, avoid them. Use that as a third option.
So we filed on January 2nd. We're beginning our stakeholder interaction. We're glad to be here today to share with you the plan. We did file on the 2nd, but then we got an order in mid-December that approved several resources after a two-year process called capacity acquisition process. So we got an order to file a supplement to address these recent decisions. And here's those decisions, if they'll come up.
And certainly you will be faced with those same decisions.
So it's called MPUC, Capacity Acquisition Process Order, 100 megawatt solar, 345 megawatt Calpine expansion combined cycle by 2019, and our Black Dog self-build for NSP, 208 megawatt natural gas CT 2019. The Aurora project is year-end 2016. The second piece, we had a very strong response to our solar gardens offering in just mid-December. We're going to reflect an increase from 100 megawatts to 300 megawatts by 2020 from customer-driven small solar in our go-forward plan. Sherco retirement scenarios. There's a specific order point that we did not address in the January 2nd filing, which was just to model and show the impacts of retiring both Sherco 1 and 2 in 2020, just to satisfy that request. Number two on that scenario is to show an earliest possible retirement scenario, just for purposes of showing that and having a discussion about it, for Sherco 1 retirement in 2020, Sherco 2 in 2023. And one of the premises for the 2020 retirement would be to use a substantial portion of our long capacity position for that offset. If the commission, as it kind of alluded to in December, wants to maintain a very strong long position as they ordered out with these additions in the first piece, then that would not make the 2020 retirement of a Sherco unit feasible, because we would have to have the additional time to build or secure that additional resource. So, and that's.
I know we're short on time. You moderate tail enough time. Do you have any other specific questions at this time that we could answer? I certainly don't take silence as confirmation.
I don't want to rush any conversation either. So I think we can.
And I will. We will also offer that certainly we'll come back and have schedule additional. I mean, to the extent that you want time to look at it, think about what we said, come up with additional questions. We'll certainly schedule additional time to come back and you know, have a more thorough discussion. Also, if you have specific issues too. So I don't want to limit either way, because okay. I don't want to rush you. I mean, a lot of information to kind of digest also, and we'd be more than happy to reschedule.
What's your time frame? You know, sometimes we ask a question and say, well, you know, that's that option, but we're talking about this option now. At some point, you need to narrow it down some in order to get Minnesota's approval. They can't approve a whole bunch of plans. I assume they're going to want it narrowed down to one that they're going to approve. So what's your time frame on that?
Well, the purpose of filing a preferred plan is to give a starting point of which then people can work off of, right? And people will debate whether they want things in the plan or out of the plan, or they want to change the plan. And that process is going to happen in this state as well as it happens in Minnesota. The time frame typically is 9 months to a year. Sometimes it takes 2 years to get through, depending upon how difficult the decisions are.
We're not trying to whittle this down and put something together here in the next couple months, and we're talking.
Correct. We're just going to start opening. We'll file the supplements in March. We've asked people to kind of hold in abeyance discovery until we have a chance to come and talk to them about the plan and to get the supplement filed. I think at that point in time, then you start getting into the typical discovery phase and setting a schedule and so forth. And so, again, I think it's going to be a fairly long time, and that's why I would suggest that we could come back and have additional discussions and meetings to discuss this.
I do have one question. I don't know if anybody else has additional ones, but just one question from this plan itself. In the summary, you talk about changing customer expectations as one of the kind of guiding principles for this. And you say that you're hearing from customers they have a growing interest in increasing their energy management capabilities and desire a more customized energy mix than has been traditionally available. So who do you hear from, and how are you hearing from your customers on this sort of stuff? And I'm curious what kind they are. Are they your commercial customers or residential? If you can characterize
sure,
that a bit for me.
Because
we don't hear a lot from our customers here demanding this type of thing. So
we have different customer groups that have been more vocal. We saw it certainly with the city of Boulder on our PSCO system. We saw it then with the city of Minneapolis on our NSP system. In the rate case that I talked about earlier, the large industrial group, which has been a pretty traditional player in rate cases from the industrial perspective, actually proposed that we present an option for a streamed wind product, where they take a new wind farm and actually identify that energy from that wind farm is dedicated to these particular customers. That's been done in Iowa and by Duke in North Carolina and a couple other utilities, so we think they were playing off of that. In part, I think they're looking at it for a price hedge against the fuel clause by getting some cheap PTC wind. We also have companies who have corporate sustainability goals who have approached our customer managers for it. And then some of these data centers that are looking at the northern jurisdictions because they like the cold weather for the data centers, a lot of those are California companies who have customer pressure to be as green as they can, and so they ask for, can we have an all-green energy option? We do. It's more anecdotal than from the residential and small business customers, but we do have some surveying that we've done that showed that, you know, the residential customers that we are seeing interest in, can I have more renewable energy options? So it's a real mix of customers.
And is it an overwhelming amount of customers? Is it most of your customers are asking for this stuff, especially like the industrial and the, you know, more the commercial types? Is it most of them that are seeking this type of new type of energy mixes, or more handfuls?
It's actually hard to characterize. From my perspective, I think we're moving from handfuls to somewhere where it's actually a large enough segment that we feel like we need to actually be responsive to it and actually start trying to anticipate where they're going. In part, we've seen a very strong interest in the community solar gardens in Minnesota. In part, we think that some of the pricing mechanism there isn't quite as appropriate as it needs to be to get the pricing signal right. So you don't want to read too much into that. Mm. When I actually walked our customer management team through the resource plan, I was actually surprised because I thought I would get a lot of response pushing back on the amount of renewable energy and what's this going to cost. I actually had quite a few of the customer relation managers saying, this is actually helpful because I've had so many customers ask me, how can you help me meet our corporate sustainability goal? Walmart, Target, 3M, these companies all have these corporate sustainability goals. So in part, they come to us saying, can you help?
Yeah.
But we can try to better quantify that, and we certainly are working to do that as we go forward.
I think that helps explain some of the differences in the you know, the policy divergence, because you have a lot of those bigger corporate companies present in Minneapolis. We don't have that kind of a push in our state. Our large companies are energy producers.
Right.
So,
among North Dakota customers specifically, do you get more calls asking for community solar gardens or streamed wind farms or better reliability in places like Fargo?
I'm looking at my team.
Right, okay. Fargo is very interested in energy efficiency. In fact, they're one of the finalists for the Georgetown Energy Award. Based on the current makeup of the city council and the mayor, we are expecting more sit-down meetings with them to address options like that. So they sort of drive us because of the franchise issues. So we will, yeah.
I'll tell you, I've had more calls about reliability.
And again, I would say that they don't have to be mutually exclusive. We're pretty proud of what we're doing with the reliability, and some of the renewable can factor into our overall mix. So I don't think they're exclusive at all. But so it is something that we're starting to see more interest. The university is interested in it. So it's not it isn't without supporters over there, but I think they still look at reliability and reasonable prices as the basis of what we provide.
All right. Anybody else have any more questions? Do you want to make any closing comments?
My thought is I don't know that we could be any more clear on where we're at. We know where you're, I think from my view, you guys know where you're at. We know where we're at. I think you can see the friction points coming. We've just got to keep talking.
Thank
you.
A lot to evaluate, though, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to come. It was great to get to meet you. Really enjoyed the discussion, and I actually look forward to coming back and working on solving the friction points as best we can. And I appreciate our friends from Otter Tail are here in the room, and I just want them to know that I like doing business in North Dakota, and we want to stay here as providing service in this state. But obviously, we enjoy working with them, and thank you for the opportunity today.
I want to thank you guys as well, and you provide a lot of good information, and I think that we have some exciting things ongoing with you with the cost allocation study and the restack, and there's just a lot of innovative, North Dakota innovative type things. Maybe not the way everyone else is doing it, but we're pushing the envelope in different ways, and I think that it all is going to result in better services to customers. So we appreciate your guys' being here in the open, candid conversation, and look forward to more of it.
Thanks. Thank you so much.